Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. 200,000 Americans dead from COVID-19. That is the grim milestone the nation hit this month. So, Tara, what do you think about the fact that we as a nation crossed that number?
I frankly am still astounded and a bit nauseated that we let this happen to this country. And remember, the 200,000 are just confirmed deaths. There are plenty more that never got diagnosed and never really made it onto the radar as COVID deaths. So I'm still astonished that we've hit that number.
Yeah. And Angie, what about you?
I feel after I got over my initial sadness, I primarily now feel anger because every single one of those deaths, as well as the deaths that haven't been counted, has really been preventable. If we had controlled transmission within this country, within communities months before, we would not be looking at this number right now.
Yeah. Well, what we have been doing over the past couple of weeks is, since we're at this roughly 6 month mark of living through this pandemic, we've been inviting back some of the best expert voices that we talked to near the beginning. And Tara and Angie are two of those best expert voices. Tara Smith is a professor of epidemiology at Kent State University. Her research focuses on zoonotic diseases and emerging infectious diseases. So, Professor Smith, let me give you my formal welcome back.
Thank you for having me have it back on.
And Angie Rasmussen is a virologist and associate research scientist at the Center for Infection and Immunity at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. So, Professor Rasmussen, here's my formal welcome back to you.
Thank you so much for having me back.
You know, I want to have you guys back for good news, but I don't think we're there yet at all in terms of the country's grappling with the pandemic. So, Professor Smith, given what you see right now in terms of the decision making coming from, let's just start with the federal government, what do you foretell for the fall in terms of that pandemic curve?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think we're going to see that increasing. We've seen that Florida, of course, is lifting all of their restrictions on, you know, inside dining and things like that. And that seems to be a bad omen. I hope other states don't follow that. I know there's been a lot of pressure here in Ohio for our governor also to reduce restrictions on indoor dining and other types of gatherings. So I'm concerned that's going to be the trend, as those of us in the scientific field are very concerned about the fall and the winter and increasing spread as people do move indoors and have less opportunities to distance outside and have that additional ventilation. So I am very concerned about what we're going to be seeing over the next two or 3 months or so as we start to get into cold weather in many places in the country.
Mm. And Angie, what do you think?
I completely agree with Tara. I think that as we move inside and as businesses reopen, as schools in many places reopen, there's just not going to be those opportunities to keep people away from each other. And since we also simultaneously in many communities don't have the testing capacity to conduct adequate surveillance, we're going to miss a lot of cases, and that's going to unfortunately result in more transmission.
So let's talk a little bit then about what measures people ought to be taking as we head deeper into the fall and the winter as well, and the messaging that's coming from the federal government. I mean, first of all, this month, Dr. Redfield, the head of the CDC, did testify before Congress saying that he thinks that face coverings at least could protect him from COVID-19 better than even a vaccine. So obviously advocating for continued wearing of face masks. I mean, that seems to be the right message, Tara, doesn't it?
Right, absolutely. I mean, I think we have to be cautious about complacency. that people are getting tired of this, understandably so, but that doesn't mean that the pandemic is getting tired of you. So I think we need to continue what we're doing. I think we need to look at places that have reopened for schools and potentially universities and keep a very close eye on transmission in those areas, that if it does get out of control, we need to shut down and take a step backward. And I don't think many places have really set up good metrics for that, as far as what it means to have a significant outbreak and when would you shut down? When would you go back to fully remote schooling or university setting? So those are the things I think we need to be thinking of this month.
So Dr. Redfield said in the testimony before Congress earlier this month, he said that he does not think that we're anywhere near this pandemic. But regarding the wearing of face coverings, he said that if every one of us did it, the pandemic would be over in 8 to 12 weeks. I mean, if every single American did it, I guess he's saying. So that's what's coming up from the head of the CDC when we do hear from him. But it gets confusing for Americans because, like, in the very same month, on September 18th, we heard something completely different from a member of the White House Coronavirus Task Force. This is Dr. Scott Atlas, who was asked by CNN's Aaron Burnett to explain President Donald Trump's decision not to require masks for people attending his political rallies. And here's what Dr. Atlas said.
There's no sound science that shows that you should have all populations wear masks in all circumstances, quote unquote, if I may quote myself. And that is very much in concert with exactly what's posted on the WHO website. And that's in concert with the president's own policy, which is a reasonable policy, which is wear masks when you cannot socially distance, particularly when you're in areas where there are high risk people. And, you know, that's what the WHO says. They say it. I'm not sure what the controversy is here. If you think that it's sound science to walk out in the middle of a desert wearing a mask when you're all alone,
right,
or if you're in your own car all alone wearing a mask, mm-hmm, or if you're running through a park all alone and you should be wearing a mask, I'm sorry, but that's neither scientific nor rational.
Dr. Scott Atlas on speaking to CNN's Aaron Burnett. So, Angie, it's... I feel like we need to parse this a little bit because he was asked about why people are not asked to wear masks during the president's rallies. And then Dr. Atlas says, well, the WHO says wear a mask when you cannot socially distance, which I think would define a political rally. But then he goes on to say, you don't have to wear one in the middle of a desert. That's not rational. I mean, the confusion in that statement, it cannot possibly help the American people understand what's best to do right now.
Well, and I think that may be the intent. Dr. Atlas has no background in epidemiology or infectious diseases. He's a neuroradiologist. And he is, I think, willfully misinterpreting the WHO guidelines. Obviously, being alone in the desert, running alone in an empty park is a very different situation than a political rally that is crowded with people. And certainly the WHO's guidance would encourage mask wearing in that situation. I think that this is intentionally muddying the waters to further confuse people and further drive the divisiveness that really is separating a lot of people and preventing them from taking the best steps to prevent transmission and reduce their own risk.
Yeah. So, Tara, I mean, I don't really want to force both of you to comment on politics here, but it is so central in terms of how this nation has responded to the pandemic. I'm looking here at reporting from NBC News just today that Dr. Redfield, the head of the CDC, acknowledged to NBC News that he had said on an airplane flight, because a reporter overheard him say this on an airplane flight, that everything Dr. Atlas says is false, Redfield said, during a phone call he made on a commercial airline flight. And just this morning, he acknowledged that he said that. He acknowledged that to NBC News. I mean, what do we need to do? If you could wave a magic wand right now, at least over messaging, over what the American people should be doing to protect themselves and their community members over the next 6 weeks, say, what should the messaging be?
Yeah, I think it's what we've been saying for months. It's distancing whenever possible. It's ventilation, doing things outside or opening windows inside. It's masks. It's washing hands. It's the things that we've said for many months. And I think most people agree with them, but I do think there is still that kind of political divisiveness that because President Trump has been reluctant to either say some of those things or, you know, actually do them in practice, that some on the right have kind of leaned toward that and not encouraged those and really put some of their constituents at risk because of that inability to kind of stand apart, I think, from President Trump and really listen to the science.
So let me fact check something with both of you, though. I mean, when Dr. Redfield says that if everyone wore masks, the pandemic would be over in 8 to 12 weeks. Is that a reasonable statement, Tara?
I don't know if it would be over. I don't think we would completely control this, but, you know, I think it would reduce a lot of transmission. One of the issues we're seeing is, of course, transmission within households, which would not be completely mitigated by masks, but what you would do is you would reduce that risk of acquiring the virus outside of the household and bringing it into the home where, of course, you wouldn't be wearing masks amongst your family members. So I think, you know, if we had done that really consistently for, you know, 8 to 12 weeks, that would really put a dent into this. And it would get us to the point where, again, we could implement testing and tracing for those few remaining cases, like many other countries have already done, in order to control what is left of that kind of remaining transmission.
Andrew, we've got to take a break here in just under a minute. Did you want to just follow up with what Tara said?
No, I agree with everything that Tara said. I think that, you know, this pandemic won't truly be over until we have a safe, effective vaccine that can be distributed worldwide and not just within the United States. But I think that the key to getting through the pandemic and returning to something that looks like normal life really is to reduce transmission. And what Tara was talking about is exactly the way to do that.
Well, we are circling back around with two experts in infectious disease this hour to see what they think about where we are in this COVID-19 pandemic. We'll have a lot more to talk about when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are circling back with two experts on infectious diseases this hour to see what they think about where we are with the COVID-19 pandemic and what the nation ought to do as we head into the fall and the winter. Tara Smith is with us. She's a professor of epidemiology at Kent State University, and her research focuses on zoonotic diseases. Angie Rasmussen is with us as well. She's a virologist and associate research scientist at the Center for Infection and Immunity at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. Now, let's listen to a moment from last Wednesday, when Missouri's governor, Republican Michael Parson, announced that he and his wife, Teresa, had both tested positive for COVID-19.
The First Lady started showing some symptoms. Sure thought the best thing to do was her to get tested. We did that earlier today, that she would test. That positive has come back, that she is positive for COVID-19. I also want you to know I was tested. Those results, the preliminary result, has come back as a positive test. We'll still wait to confirm that later today to make sure we have that officially, but right now we're taking all precautions moving forward. Right now I feel fine, no symptoms of any kind, but right now we just got to take the quarantine procedures in place.
So that's Missouri Governor Michael Parson talking about the fact that he's tested positive, and his wife as well, for COVID-19, saying individually they're taking all precautions moving forward. However, collectively, Governor Parson has still refused to issue a statewide mandate on mask wearing. So Tara Smith, you're there in Ohio. Talk to us a little bit about what's happening in Missouri and what you've been seeing more broadly in terms of the pandemic in rural areas of the country.
Right. So, yeah, Missouri is one of 16 states that lacks a mask mandate. And a number of those have seen recent increases in coronavirus cases. We've seen upticks in Alaska and Iowa and Utah in both of the Dakotas. And then, of course, his cases in Missouri. And so, not surprisingly, a lot of those are also, again, kind of on that political divide. Most of those are Republican-led states. Here in Ohio, we do have a Republican governor who did finally implement a mask mandate over the summer after taking some time to try to let people do it voluntarily, which did not work very well. But even here in the state, we are seeing more cases per capita in our rural communities right now than in our larger urban areas. So while early in the pandemic, we had outbreaks in Cleveland and Columbus and Toledo and in some of our large urban settings. Right now, of our 10 10 counties that have the highest per capita incidence of coronavirus, 8 of those are rural counties with populations of 20 to 30,000. But we're really seeing spread in those in part because of lack of mask wearing and really kind of resistance to even believing that the pandemic is happening at all. Many people still believing that it is some kind of a partisan hoax rather than a true epidemic.
So 8 of the 10 counties are rural that have the highest current per capita spread rate. And so what could happen if those numbers aren't brought under control? What could happen in those counties?
Yeah, I think what we're going to see is this will really hopscotch across not only the state, but what we're seeing is that happens across the country, that it ends up in one of these little areas and spreads there. And one of the big concerns right now is that we're still not seeing our hospitalizations go up rapidly. But the concern, of course, is that these rural areas do not have hospitals that are well prepared. They're still understaffed. They're underfunded. They're relatively sparse in some areas of the country, especially the rural areas in the South that really lack these rural hospitals. So the worst case scenario, of course, is that you get a really large outbreak in one of these counties and you don't have the facilities that can handle those types of outbreaks. And so fatality rate will increase in many of these areas.
I was just going to ask about that, right? Because just to underscore the point you made, many of these counties already, people living there already have a challenge when it comes to accessing healthcare, right? And hospitals, specialized care, et cetera. That's already a fact of life in many of these places. And it sounds like you're saying that the pandemic could make just that much worse.
Absolutely. And they tend to have more of the risk factors that go along with what we're seeing for severe COVID cases as well. They tend to be older in general. They tend to have higher body weights, higher incidence of diabetes and other pre-existing conditions that can make a COVID infection more severe. So we're definitely concerned about those individuals and those areas to be able to manage this pandemic.
Angie, when you hear Tara describe what's happening in some of the rural counties in the United States, what's your response as a virologist?
Well, I mean, this virus doesn't really care if you're a person living in an urban or a rural setting. As a human being, I'm very concerned for the reasons that Tara just mentioned. I mean, the fact is this virus only cares about getting a new host. That's all viruses are programmed to do. And it doesn't matter if, you know, that host is living in a rural setting or in an urban setting. What matters is that person, and will they be able to access the healthcare they need? What will be their outcome? And we know already that this virus doesn't cause severe disease in the majority of people who get it. But if a lot of people get it, then that means that a lot of people will get very sick just because of the numbers. And if you are exceeding what your hospitals are able to manage, that means that a lot of people will potentially die from this. It's very concerning.
Hmm. So let's then fold in some analysis from both of you on, I've been seeing a lot of news stories here and there about whether or not the virus itself is mutating, or is SARS-CoV-2's transmissibility changing? Angie, what do we know about that?
So this all goes back to a paper that was published a few months ago that showed that there was a mutation in the spike protein. And the spike protein is the protein that's on the surface of the virus particle and binds the receptor to allow the virus to enter and infect a cell. It wasn't really known what was going on with this in terms of how it changed the spike protein's function. And currently, we still have no evidence of that. This paper made the conclusion that because this mutation was more common in Europe and in North America, including in the U.S., that it was somehow more transmissible. But that can actually be explained by a number of other things. It could just be that more of that variant was imported from Europe, and so there were already larger numbers of viruses with that mutation circulating. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's making the virus more transmissible, or that if you're infected with a variant that has what's called the D614G mutation, which some of my colleagues have started calling Doug, if you have a Doug spike protein, it doesn't necessarily indicate that you're going to be more contagious. That said, it's really important that virologists start doing the work in animal models and experimental systems to see if that mutation has any effect. But right now, we don't know that for sure. There's no indication, really strong indication, that it's doing anything. And it doesn't appear, in good news, it doesn't appear that it alters vaccine specificity for the virus, for the spike protein. Mm. So there's more work to be done, but right now it's nothing to be alarmed about. Viruses mutate anyways. That's just what they do.
Okay. Tara, let me turn back to you to hear what you think about that. And by the way, I just want to emphasize to both of you that, like, you don't need to wait for me to sort of referee who gets what question. Just jump in there. Half of what I want to do is, like, hear the two of you talk with each other so that, like, we can, it'll help us understand, like, how we should all better think through this. So just let it rip. Go ahead, Tara.
Sure. Yeah, no, I completely agree. I mean, looking epidemiologically, there have been a couple studies in addition to that first one. There was one recently published from Texas and another one in the UK that found similar results, that this mutation does seem to kind of get to a high level in populations. But as Angie mentioned, we really don't know why that is, and whether it is actually because it is being selected for in the population, or because it's just kind of a founder effect, like was mentioned, that basically this is the virus that got into that population. So of course, it's the one that is replicating there. So those are some things that really haven't been teased out yet. And also, you know, while some of the studies suggest that this virus may replicate at higher levels in the upper respiratory tract than those that lack the mutation, you know, that's only one part of transmission. So transmission, you know, you have to have a new host acquire the virus. It enters the host cells, it replicates in there, it leaves the host cells, and then it has to leave the host and go to a new host. And all of that is pretty complicated. So I think that the idea that one particular mutation would be driving all of that, I think, is a little bit unlikely from my point of view. But again, we really need to understand what is happening with this and look at other mutations that are occurring as well to see if they have any alteration on transmissibility or on, you know, the potential vaccines that may be coming out.
Mm. I promise not to get in between the two of you, but I'm going to do it right now just for one quick second here, because I'm just trying to, like, pull together all the threads of information and misinformation that people have had to untangle over the past month or so. And so another one of those threads is about herd immunity, which has reared its head again. Okay, so let's just listen to a moment from a congressional hearing last week on Wednesday, when Kentucky Senator Rand Paul and Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, they had quite a heated exchange over something Senator Paul asserted, that herd immunity might be developing in New York.
They are looking at the guidelines that we have put together from the task force of the four or five things of masks, social distancing, outdoors more than indoors, avoiding crowds, and washing hands.
Or they've developed enough community immunity right. that they're no longer having the pandemic because they have enough immunity in New York City to actually stop.
I challenge that, Senator.
I'm afraid, please, sir,
I would like to be able to do this because this happens with Senator Rand all the time. You were not listening to what the director of the CDC said, that in New York, it's about 22%. If you believe 22% is herd immunity, I believe you're alone in that.
So that was Dr. Anthony Fauci and Senator Rand Paul on Wednesday. Okay, so Tara and Angie, let's kind of take this on with some methodology. First of all, give us a definition. When we talk about herd immunity and COVID, what exactly do we mean?
So this kind of means two things. What herd immunity means to me and Tara is herd immunity is when you have enough people in the population who are immune to a virus that it can't spread within that population because viruses need hosts. They can't replicate without a host. So if enough people are resistant to it or immune to it, then that virus won't be able to spread anymore. We've always achieved this historically through vaccines and not through natural infection. What herd immunity is being used to describe by Dr. Paul or Senator Paul is the concept that we could achieve this by natural infection, which again is something we've never really managed to do with any other pathogen. And that 22% of people having antibodies to the virus in New York City because of the large outbreak there last spring means that herd immunity has been achieved. And I don't think anybody thinks 22% seropositivity or antibody positivity would ever lead to herd immunity.
Right, and I agree. And there have been some models. So typically based on the spread of this virus, which on average, a person who is infected will spread it to about, let's say, about three other people. So what that means is that to get to a herd immunity level, you need somewhere around 60% of the population to be immune to this, to reach herd immunity levels. Now, there have been some models where it does suggest that you can reach those levels because of some of the way the population mixes with levels lower than 60%. But yeah, 22%, I haven't seen any models that go that low. So I don't think even in New York City, which of course is one of our hardest hit areas in the United States, I don't think they're anywhere close to herd immunity's level yet.
Okay, so you were saying 60%, but New York 22%. So even just New York would have to have three times as many people having
right.
Been exposed or having had COVID.
Correct.
At least 21,000 people died in New York City. So to achieve herd immunity of 60%, is it linear? Would that mean 60,000 people, 60,000 deaths in New York City, or does the epidemiology work differently? I mean, how many? I guess what I'm asking is how many deaths come with achieving that herd immunity?
Right. And I don't think you would get 60,000 deaths because since the beginning, you know, we have learned, I think, how to treat it a little bit better. That has improved over time. We're also seeing, you know, younger people get this, which have lower death rates. So I don't know that you would necessarily have to get to 60,000 deaths, but okay. Definitely, you know, with herd immunity comes those people that are infected and you will have deaths. So it may be 40,000 deaths, but instead of 60,000, but it still means a lot more people that will suffer and will die from this. And of course, even in those young people we have the big kind of black box question mark of what happens with long-term effects. So even if they survive, they may still have these long-term complications. So I don't think we want to use herd immunity as our way to get out of this pandemic. There are just too many issues that come along with that.
Angie, what do you think?
Yeah, I think I completely agree with Tara. I think that nationwide, if you were to try to achieve natural herd immunity, not just in New York City, you would be looking at minimum hundreds of thousands of deaths. Mm-hmm. I think that it's, again, we've never really achieved herd immunity through natural infection. There's also a lot of really unanswered questions about how long and how robust immunity is. We certainly know that antibody levels correlate with disease severity. So it's possible that the people who are getting mild disease may not have lasting functional immune protection. There's just a lot that we don't really know. So my feeling is that we should absolutely not consider a natural herd immunity as a strategy to end the pandemic. Again, the only way to end the pandemic via herd immunity is to develop a safe and effective vaccine that would allow people to have robust, hopefully long-lasting immunity with very little cost in lives.
Well, we are circling back around with two infectious disease experts. We talked to them about 5 months ago near the beginning of this pandemic, asking them, where are we now? Where's the country now with the COVID pandemic? And what do we need to do as we head into the fall and winter? We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour with Tara Smith. She's a professor of epidemiology at Kent State University. Her research focuses on zoonotic diseases and other emerging infectious diseases. Angie Rasmussen is also with us. She's a virologist and associate research scientist at the Center for Infection and Immunity at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. And we talked to both of them about 5 months ago near the beginning of the pandemic. And we're circling back around to see sort of what they're thinking about where we are as a nation regarding COVID-19 and what we ought to do as the fall and winter approach. Now, we were talking about herd immunity before, or the concept of herd immunity before the break. And before we move fully away from that, Tara, I'm wondering, I heard you say, just to reiterate, that we've never actually achieved herd immunity without the aid of a vaccine. But I'm still seeing sort of ideas of maybe not in the United States, but other countries about how to possibly let herd immunity develop by keeping vulnerable populations indoors, for example, and letting other populations sort of move about more freely. I mean, are any of these ideas, Tara, do you think they're legitimate?
Yeah, I think those break down pretty quickly once you start to operationalize those. So there was a report out of the UK where there was some analysis of trying to do that. And so, you know, you have first your population who would be considered vulnerable. Okay, and so how do you define that? Is it only by age? Is it by other pre-existing conditions? You know, how do you determine who is vulnerable to this? And then once you do that, that's a fairly decent chunk of the population. And then you have to look at those people who interact with them. So, you know, many of those people live with or have close contact with maybe their children, who may be younger and healthier, but they have to visit their parents, you know, maybe they live with them, or maybe they have to get them things several times a week, or maybe they're caretakers for them, then you have to isolate those individuals as well. And, you know, perhaps their children, so the grandchildren of those initial vulnerable people. And by that point, you have a really large chunk of the population who is going to have to be isolated or protected. And so I think that's, you know, it's this interesting idea in theory to just protect those vulnerable people. But really, when you start to tear it apart and see how that would work, it just comes apart, and there it makes it much more difficult to deal with and to see how tough it is to, you know, quote unquote, protect those individuals from the virus, because you always have those gaps where it could get into their household. Mm.
So this brings us actually, in a sense, back to where we started. Because one thing that just keeps coming up over and over and over again across the past 6 months is, while a vaccine is being developed, there are things that we could have been doing that would have actually allowed the United States to operate relatively normally, right? I mean, we mask, facial coverings, testing. I mean, like, these are things that if we had done, maybe we wouldn't have these debates about herd immunity or how to open schools or when to let people back into their favorite restaurants. I mean, Angie, how far are we still from the basics that we could or should have in place?
I think you're completely right about that. I mean, if we had done what some countries in Europe have done, if we got community transmission down to a manageable level and simultaneously increased our testing and surveillance capacity, we would be able to live relatively normal lives, albeit with some changes. I mean, we'd have to be monitoring community spread. But it's really only when you have low enough transmission in the community that you can put into place these tried and true epidemiologic measures for controlling outbreaks. And that includes being able to test enough people that you can catch these cases early on, since we know this virus is driven by pre-symptomatic transmission or transmission by people who aren't yet aware that they're sick. If we are able to identify those cases, and if we have so few of them that it becomes manageable to isolate them, to contact trace and quarantine their contacts, we could be breaking those chains of community transmission, and we would be able to go out in public and interact with our communities in a more normal way. But we haven't done that. And unfortunately, as we talked about earlier, Florida is opening up bars and restaurants for indoor dining. They actually have higher levels of community transmission than when some states did that back at the beginning of the summer. And we all know that the result of that was the summer surge. So I am feeling pretty pessimistic about what we're doing now. It's really kind of putting our fingers in our ears and pretending that there's not a pandemic going on, when in reality, if we had controlled this months ago, we would be able to do this and do it safely.
Yeah, and that's what we were hoping for in the spring. You know, people complain about the lockdowns and how business as usual still can't be conducted. But that was really the goal of some of these lockdowns, you know, back before Memorial Day, was to give a little bit of time, a little bit of leeway to ramp up our testing capacity, to put in place surveillance mechanisms and testing and tracing, so that we could go about that more normal type of living. And that just didn't happen. We still didn't have the tests available by the end of May that we were hoping for. And all of this has really snowballed since then. And as places opened up, of course, cases increased. So that makes it much more difficult to do that type of testing and tracing in a, you know, rapid capacity so you can control that spread. I think we're kind of beyond that right now,
yeah,
in many areas, at least.
You know, You're right. Like lockdowns were meant to buy us some time. And I also just want to acknowledge that like lockdowns are draconian. They are. I mean, they're hard. Asking people to essentially suspend their lives for a period of time is not an easy thing to do. No one wants to go back to that, right? I don't hear anyone today saying they want to go back to that. But that is exactly why I must be missing something. I feel like something's very fundamentally broken here because it seems to me to be a no-brainer to say we can try to avoid going back into lockdown if we just take these other steps, right? Which we've known for several months now. Getting more testing out there, having people wear masks. Like we can achieve a kind of functioning normalcy by doing these basic things, which should be no-brainers. I mean, it shouldn't be controversial. And I just I can't quite bridge the gap on why there's resistance to that. So Tara, specifically for you, I mean, because you talked a lot about rural communities and rural spread. When do people come to you and say, "Here's why I don't want to do it"? I mean, and what's your response to them?
Oh yeah, I mean, I read the comments of our local news, and it's always fake pandemic, and even those who are on the right, and we have again a Republican governor in Ohio who did put in this mask mandate and some of the other control measures. Some have sought his impeachment already. They want him out of office. They don't like him any longer. So it is kind of a bizarre thing to look at that people from his own party even are really decrying the measures that he has put in place to try to keep Ohioans safe. And so I really think this is something that needs to come from, a strong federal response, which we have completely lacked, but we've seen in most other countries that has really been the thing to kind of turn the tide, that everyone in the country is doing the same thing. They're following the same rules. They're under the same, lockdowns or other rules, whatever it may be. And we have completely lacked that. So we've put it onto the governors, or in some cases, even, local mayors have had to be the ones to make these decisions. And when you have such a patchwork of different rules for different areas without any kind of central, strong response, I think that's just led to a lot of disillusionment. Why can they do this in this other border city, but I can't, I can't go out to a bar in mine or something. So I think we're missing that leadership that really could have gotten us through this.
Angie, what do you think?
Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think that it has actually been compounded by the fact that our federal leadership, besides being disorganized and very confusing in terms of the messages they're putting out, has really been undermined by the president's comments on their own. I mean, the president has kind of gone all across the board over the course of the pandemic. One moment saying, we need to lock down back in the spring. And then, as recently as last weekend, questioning whether masks are effective, discouraging their use, discouraging these measures that would really keep people safe, and effectively saying that the pandemic itself has been overblown and it doesn't affect anybody. And I think when that type of message is coming from the top and is being intentionally used to divide people politically, it makes it very challenging to get everybody on the same page and feel like we're all in this together. And I think that really over the course of this pandemic has been one of the main drivers of why we're still in the position that we're in.
Especially when we know that the president back in March knew how contagious and deadly COVID was. I mean, he told Bob Woodward as much. We know that. He didn't tell the public, but he told Bob Woodward. I mean, even to the point where he told Woodward that someone once sneezed in the Oval Office and they all cleared out the Oval Office, all of them, because they didn't want to risk catching COVID. I mean, we've got about 5 minutes left here. And the two of you have been dedicating your lives, your professional lives, to studying infectious diseases and viruses. And the past 6 months, every waking moment, to this one pandemic. And I just wanted to switch gears a little bit, if you'd allow me to, Tara and Angie, and just kind of ask, how have you guys been doing? Are you exhausted?
Yes, that's probably the understatement of the year. I'm incredibly exhausted, and I feel like almost like a COVID robot these days. Like I can't get away from it. It's my job, talking about it all the time. It's really important, especially with all the disinformation, to communicate it. But man, it is really exhausting. And I, like everybody else, just really can't wait for this pandemic to be over, even though I know it's not going to be anytime soon.
Right. And I completely agree. I mean, there's this weird meme that has gotten out there that I think people in science and public health are enjoying this, which is completely the opposite, I will say, for all of my colleagues. You know, they're overworked. They're stressed, especially some of the, you know, physicians and first line responders. They are just having such a hard time with this, and we're all ready for this to go back to some type of normal. And, you know, we understand that we still have a long way to go, and this is going to be difficult on all of us, but we're all exhausted. We're all kind of demoralized at this point, and we all just want to get through this as quickly and safely as possible at this point.
Do you feel demoralized, Tara?
Occasionally. I mean, social media is a bear anyway, and to see some of the comments on there, to see people still denying this, you know, when I have, you know, friends who have been very ill from this, and, you know other individuals who have passed from this, it is tough to take on some days.
So can you tell me both what are your days like? I mean, 'cause I'm trying to put myself in your shoes of living and breathing this pandemic day in and day out. I mean, Angie, like when you wake up in the morning, like what's your first thought about what you have to do that day?
Usually my first thought is I wish I could go back to sleep. But I usually get up around 5 or 5:30 in the morning. That's my time to kind of check Twitter. And it used to be like, let's see what cool new science is out today. And now it's more like, let's see what fires I'm going to have to put out today. And then, you know, over the course of the day, it's trying to juggle speaking with the media, which I think is really important to do just because so much misinformation has caused so many problems that it's really important for me to be able to contribute any kind of like evidence-based perspective that I can, and trying to juggle that with, just, you know, maintaining my household, feeding myself, like taking a shower, like the normal things that everybody needs to do, as well as trying to finish my manuscript that seems to be never ending, so I can get my own preprint out. It's just a lot of stuff to juggle. I feel like most days I'm kind of juggling like torches or chainsaws or something. I feel like if anything drops, something bad's going to happen. But I don't know what to do besides, you know, continuing to juggle.
I want to be perfectly honest right now and say it pushes me to the edge of a intense rage to hear that that a scientist like you, who should be able to devote every hour of your working days to laboratory work, that you have to spend so much time thinking, what fires do I have to fight because of the virus that is media? I mean, that's terrible.
Yeah, it's really frustrating, and I completely agree with Tara that social media, I have met people like Tara actually on social media. That's how we got connected. I've made collaborative relationships through social media. It has been in many ways very, very good. But then I also see a lot of people saying, you know, that masks don't work, pushing all this misinformation, saying terrible things about Tony Fauci. It's like a never ending stream of vitriol sometimes. And it's incredibly frustrating, but if we don't push back on it, I don't know who will. So it fills me with rage too many days, and sometimes it fills me with a lot of sadness, and mostly just exhaustion. But I'm going to be thinking about this for a long time. I don't really know how we got here, and just like everybody else, I'm trying to make sense of it all.
Yeah. Tara, we've got about 30 seconds, but go ahead. How are you doing?
Yeah, just hanging in there. I mean, I also have a first grader who's doing remote school, and my siblings and I balance taking care of our elderly mother who also has a lot of health issues. So, you know, we're just playing it day by day and trying to keep on top of everything as much as we can.
Remote school. We didn't even go there in terms of another layer to all of this that's affecting all of our lives. But Tara Smith, professor of epidemiology at Kent State University. Professor Smith, thank you so much for being with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
And Angie Rasmussen, associate research scientist at the Center for Infection and Immunity at the Columbia School of Public Health. Angie, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Megan. It was a pleasure to be here.
This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.